Welcome to another episode of That's So Cincinnati. The band is back together today. Welcome my co-host, Burl Love.
I am back.
It's been a minute. We are allowed to go on vacations.
nobody missed me.
You guys didn't miss a beat.
I
missed you, but I had a really good time with Sydney doing it, though. Sydney and I are friends, and
I know. That was a good podcast.
And we
did highly recommend
talking about fashion, which Sydney and I talk about fashion a lot. And
right.
We did not do that.
Well, you two are the fashion templates of the newsroom.
So, yeah, we kept it very newsy. Since she and I are writing about connected communities, I promised no stories have appeared yet, but we're on it, you guys. We promise.
Connected communities. Give me that, just the elevator pitch, connected communities.
It's a zoning overhaul.
Zoning.
It is. It's very important to the city.
But it's stirring up some big feelings.
It's stirring up big feelings, and it did need a better name than zoning reform. So kudos to connected communities.
Connected communities. So in a nutshell, they're trying to spark some development, urban renewal by changing some zoning.
Yes, along like the biggest like metro routes to really, really increase density and population in the neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm.
And so the zoning code is complicated, dated, old. And so there's a lot of reforms coming to it to make it easier to build. But part of that is it is complicated. It is dense. And so there's a little bit of the fear of unknown, but things are ramping up and there's a lot of information coming out about it now.
And you're all over that. More to come with your reporting. You know, we do resist change in Cincinnati, wouldn't
That's
you say?
True.
Or
yes.
It makes us nervous.
It does.
So, all right. Well, more to come on that. But actually, a little bit of news from your beat this week.
So as we record today, nothing's happened yet, but P.G. Sittenfeld, the former council member who was convicted on federal corruption charges, federal corruption law is very complicated. And so he is appealing his conviction. And, you know, this doesn't happen in every federal case. PG was granted a review of his case by the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals with an actual oral arguments that are going to be happening on Thursday, which as a reporter, like a courts reporter, like getting to cover local cases that kind of, you know, get, you know, these special reviews, it's kind of exciting. So this is going to be on Thursday.
The day this podcast drops. We're
yes.
recording earlier in the
yes,
week.
But we're not going to have an answer that day anyway. But
so what is expected that day? That's just going to be they get a chance to make their arguments.
15 minutes each side. But then really what you're looking for is a question from the justices. And we do know it's a 3-judge panel. We do know that this panel is 3 justices appointed by President Donald Trump to really kind of get at the idea of federal corruption law. Like, did P.G. Sittenfeld violate it? A jury said that he did. So this was a jury case, and he is in prison right now as this is all happening. And so we'll get to hear what happens. It's going to take forever. Probably he'll be out of prison by the time we get a decision. He asked for a speedy look at this case, mm-hmm. and he was denied that because he was like, I'll be out of prison probably. But
And remind us, how long was his sentence?
16 months.
16 months, which he's already served, gosh, 4 or 5?
We're in the fifth month.
Fifth month.
Yeah.
So you're right. If it takes...
He won't serve that whole 16. That would be a surprise. Like,
right.
You have to serve like 80% of your sentence.
And it would be a surprise if this led to anything significant, I think.
Well, looking at the judge panel, it's hard to guess.
But it would have to be...
We've seen the U.S. Supreme Court overturn some federal corruption convictions, so I guess you never know.
Never know, but it would have to be, I think, and I'm not as well researched on this as you are, that they would have to present something pretty significant to have anything overturned. Like, I guess I'll put it this way. It would be a big deal to go against what a jury has decided. It would have to be a very big deal.
No, 100%. And honestly, there has been, you know, some passing mentions of this in national publications looking at federal corruption law. So this case is being looked at nationally to see what happens. And so,
The last thing anyone wants to do, I think, is create more loopholes or wiggle room for people to operate in that way. So,
unless they do want to do that, Pearl. It is politics.
It is politics. Well, we're not going to talk about politics today for our special guest.
No, we have a much lighter topic than connected communities, and we love connected communities, but much lighter topic. I'm very excited to welcome our special guest today. It is
Emily Henry,
New York Times bestselling author.
Like,
from here, again, from Cincinnati.
Yes, yeah. From Cincinnati. Moved back to Cincinnati, still writing romance novels
yeah,
that land on the top of the New York Times bestselling list. She's got movie rights sold to her books.
So we're going to ask her all about
that. And you have read every book,
Sherry. I have. I found her during the pandemic when her first romance novel came out. And then I'm like, you know, there are books I actually buy. So I'm a big library person these days on my Kindle, like downloading like the ebooks on my Kindle from the library. And I'm willing to wait because there's such a long list of books that I want to read. Mm-hmm. But with her, there's very few books I do buy. I buy her books on day one.
All right. Well, so many questions to ask Emily Henry. Let's jump right in.
Special guest time here on That's So Cincinnati. I'm so excited today to welcome a local author, but best-selling number one New York Times author, Emily Henry, with her book, Funny Story. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
I think that, you know, we should probably start at the beginning, honestly, but does everybody pretty much start like with the idea of like, is there a funny story?
Is there a funny story? You mean like a funny story behind the book?
A play off of the words funny story.
Sorry, what was that?
Like a play off of the words funny story kind of.
I mean, that is very much what the book is. Like, I mean, there, like, the concept kind of came to me from the idea that, like, a lot of times the things that happen to us in real life that are really upsetting at the time or very disappointing or just bizarre, a lot of times become very funny stories later. And not only that, like, not only are they like our favorite anecdotes to trot out at parties, like the bad things that happen to us, but I think that a lot of times the really good stuff that happens to us in life comes directly from some of the worst things. And it's like, not necessarily that it makes you glad bad things happened, but, you know, there are outcomes that you can trace back directly to parts of your life that you didn't plan. And, you know, it becomes like you're almost grateful for the bad things because they led you to some of the best parts of life.
And in the case of Funny Story, that's exactly what happened. The book is about a really terrible breakup, but it leads to love.
Yes.
I don't want to, spoiler alert, it leads to love in the end.
Yeah. So like you said, I mean, the premise for anyone who, again, we won't do spoilers. We're good. You're safe here in the hands of That So Cincinnati. But the premise is basically that these two people have just been dumped by their significant others because their significant others have finally accepted that they're in love with each other. So Daphne's fiance is broken up with her for his childhood best friend. And then his childhood best friend Petra has dumped her boyfriend Miles to be with Daphne's ex-fiance. So it's this weird couple swap situation where it's basically like the scorned lovers end up sharing an apartment because they need someone to fill in the other half of their rent now that they've both just been dumped. And it's like, you know, sort of a misery loves company scenario. And even though, like, you know, a breakup is horrible, and especially this one that they're going through is almost bizarrely, absurdly horrible. I also think even in the moment, sometimes those things are really funny. Like, you can be aware that the things that are happening to you are so on the nose or over the top or whatever, and find the humor in it. And so, like, from the beginning, there's sort of this like screwball edge to it, even though they're in this deep, despairing pit.
The main character of this book is a librarian. And I feel like you might have an affinity to libraries as a writer.
Yeah, I mean, for sure. I am was definitely a library kid, and I still am a frequent library user. And I also, you know, like, have a couple of close friends who are librarians and or just work in libraries and are not technically librarians. But I would always hear like their funny stories, honestly, about working in the library, because the library is like the most human place on the planet. It's like, because it's a public place that anybody can go, it's everyone. It's people from all different kinds of backgrounds, from all different walks of life. And everybody is welcome unless they do something really, really, really bad. And even then, sometimes like the things that I would hear about patrons getting banned for, it's like a temporary ban because once again, they brought a live squirrel into the library. So I thought it would be fun to play with those kinds of funny stories too, like kind of your workplace mishaps.
And one of the patrons, and we won't talk too much about it, but one of the patrons of the library in the book is a young person who found like a home in the library. And I just love that. I loved libraries my whole life. And I just, that was just such a sweet little side story of like a young teenage girl who found her home there.
Yeah, I think, you know, maybe not all readers, but so many readers can relate to that. I remember the first time that I went to a library to get a library card, being blown away that all of those books were accessible and free, and that I believe like I could take home as many as I wanted, or if there was a limit, it was like high enough that I was not hitting the limit. And that just felt so magical. And, you know, as somebody who's always loved reading, when you see a room full of books and you can take any of them, you can read any of them, it really does feel like you're standing in this like portal where you can go anywhere you want to go. And it's exhilarating and it's comforting. And I don't know, like every library feels kind of different, but there's something familiar about all of them. And I've always loved them. I think that I always will. And I think it's something that a lot of us readers relate to, is just like the sense that when you're in this place, any, you can be in this library in any city, any state, it's sort of like you're at your home library. Like it's still familiar. It's comforting.
So you grew up here, right? In Liberty Township?
Yeah. So my family was originally from the West Coast, and we wound up in Northern Kentucky when I was 5. And so I was there until I was about 14. And then I went to high school up in Liberty Township, and then went away to school in Michigan and did a residency in New York, and then came back to Cincinnati and have been here ever since.
So I want to know, as we're talking about the book, Funny Story, you draw inspirations, I'm sure, from lots of places. You talked about the library. Are the characters in Funny Story loosely based on people you know?
No, I mean, I like to take specific details from real life more than I like to take something wholesale. So like, you know, there's a lot of quirky little small businesses in most of my books, and there's, you know, yeah, funny neighbors and family members and all of that. Like, I find that by taking just little details from real life, they can make a character feel really lived in and give them a sense of history. Like if a character has a really specific tattoo, or like, I don't know, like a bracelet that they wear, whatever, every little detail you give them adds to their history and their realness and their depth. So there's no one in Funny Story that is, you know, like a one for one copy of anyone I know in real life, but there's like a lot of little familiar details. And that's the case for all of my books. I mean, like in my last book before this, Happy Place, there was one of the friends in the book was like an urban farmer who has little vegetable tattoos on her knuckles. And like, I have a friend who's an urban farmer with little vegetable tattoos on her knuckles. And the character is not her. They're very different. But there are just those pieces that I think ground characters and make them feel like people instead of ink on a page.
So you must be a habitual people watcher to pick up that kind of detail and remember it and weave it into your stories.
Yeah, I think probably, maybe not most, but I think a lot of writers are. It's not like I'm even intentionally doing that. I remember back in college, I would try to do that. I would take like a little Moleskine notebook and like sit out on a bench and just try to pay attention to small little details about people that could be squirreled away for later. And, you know, I do that same thing for settings. Like if I'm traveling, visiting a place I think I'd like to write about, then I'll home in on certain images and write down little details. And then I'll find it later in my notes app where it's like a bunch of fat bumblebees around like lavender in Italy, because that was like something small that I saw. And I knew that just documenting that would help the setting feel like a little bit more real. But yeah, I mean, I think that that's kind of the people piece of things. I think that's the main thing that interests me about writing, is it feels like you're observing human nature in a way, but without looking at real people. You're just kind of like building weird little dolls and moving them around. I think observation is something that I've always done a lot of. And maybe, again, that's a part of being a reader and feeling like your life is sort of a story. You're paying attention to the details and looking for the themes and the motifs and all of that. I'm not really sure.
So you said you did a residency in New York, which does seem like where writers would want to be and like the mecca for writing. What made you come back to Cincinnati?
Well, New York is very expensive. I'm not sure if anyone has ever told you that. So that was part of it. Honestly, part of it was just like, I'm going to go back to Cincinnati. I'm going to pay off some of my student loan debt. Maybe I'll go to grad school down the road. And like, there was definitely a time when I got back to Cincinnati that I really thought I was going to go back to New York and I would end up there. And that was not even like a concrete goal. It just seemed like a natural progression of where I was going. And then I got back here and like settled back into my rhythms and built new rhythms and just like kind of fell in love with the city for the first time. I mean, honestly, for the first time, because growing up here, I was like up in the suburbs and I had like my core group of friends and the things I liked doing, the places I liked going, but I was there because my parents were there, you know, it wasn't a decision. And so there's something really special, I think, about choosing your home once you've gone to see some other places. And like, I loved Michigan. I loved New York. I still love getting back to both of those, but it's really nice to be in a place where when you go on a trip, at the end of it, you're excited to get home. And that's how I feel about Cincinnati. I love the pace of this city. Like, you just don't have to hustle as hard as you do elsewhere. And everything is 20 minutes away. It feels like no matter where you are in the city, every place you'll want to go is just 20 minutes from where you are. And like you can have a yard. I don't know, just like a lot of really practical things that didn't matter to me so much in my 20s. But now I really, really appreciate having.
I mean, this really resonates with me. My husband, who also works here, as our listeners know, went to Columbia University for grad school. And when we moved to Cincinnati, we're not from here, he said, really want to end up in New York. And I was like, yeah. Well, can we just do it by way of Cincinnati? I wanted to come to the Inquirer and take this job. And he's like, we can go to Cincinnati. But 5 years in, I was like, okay, I did make a promise to you. But by then we realized we loved it here. For reporters, we get to cover a lot of like news, big city news. He covers Procter & Gamble and Kroger, and there's so much news here. And we have a yard, and we're raising a family, and we love it here. And so we don't want to go to New York. It's very expensive there.
Yeah, and like, you know, when you can, I don't know, there was a time, too, once I'd kind of given up on the dream of New York, that I was like, should I go back out west? I have, like, all my extended family is there, and I was considering it. But there are just so many great people here, and it's like, I don't know, it's like a central city where it's like it's pretty easy to get to other cities and like pretty affordable to fly to a lot of places. It really just ended up feeling like this is the place I want to live, and everywhere else are the places that like I want to travel. I think like kind of those smaller Midwestern cities are like, they tend to be hidden gems. The people who live there are very proud of them and know what makes them special, but again, because they're sort of secret spots, there's not the same level of competition. And so the like hustle culture isn't as severe. You don't have to necessarily work like 90 hours a week to make a living.
So you, since you're onto that, so Cincinnati podcast, we have to ask you, Sherry mentioned you went to Lakota East High School. That's the big question here. Where'd you go to high school? When did you realize that you wanted to be an author? Was it in high school? Were there any teachers or people in your life that influenced you? Or when you said, I want to write romance novels, they looked at you and thought, maybe you should have a plan B. You know, what was it like?
Well, I knew I wanted to be an author from the time I was 8 years old. And that's honestly, I feel like says more about our culture than it does about me, because 8 years old was like the first time I was in a class where we were asked to imagine what we were going to be when we grew up. We had like an assignment where we had to write like an autobiography, which is so funny because we were 8 years old. So it was like a predictive autobiography. It's like, here is who I will be. Here's where I'll live. Here's what my pet will be named, whatever. And so, you know, being posed with that question of like, what do you want to be when you grow up? Reading was my favorite thing. And I had been writing a little bit just because when I would get caught up on a series or I'd finish a book that I'd loved, I would want it to keep going. And I didn't know the term fan fiction. And I wasn't technically writing fan fiction because I was always creating my own characters and whatever, but my own worlds. But I would just want the feeling of what I was reading to keep going. I would want that feeling of loving a character or loving a setting and like, you know, magic, whatever. I would just want to extend it. And so I was already writing, and then being posed with the question of like, what will you be when you grow up? It was kind of the first time I realized, oh, authors are just people. Like, they're just people out there, and this is their job. They're getting paid to write these books. And that was very exciting to me, because I found out then that like I was going to have a job, and here was one that was like immediately interesting to me. So from then on, that was kind of in the back of my head. And I definitely bounced around a bit in my interests. Like in high school, I got really into dance. And at that point I was like, I just want to be a dancer. I want to be a modern dancer. I, you know, writing is fine. It's whatever. But I applied to a liberal arts school that offered like some various like arts scholarships. And so I applied for the writing scholarship, and I went and auditioned for the dance scholarship, and I did not get the dance scholarship because I was nowhere near good enough to deserve that. But I did get the writing scholarship. And part of the qualification of that was that I would have to take like one or two writing classes a year to keep the scholarship money. And so I went to this school really thinking I was going to be studying modern dance, and then ended up falling back in love with writing, with like the writing classes that I was taking there. And I kept studying dance all through college, and I was part of like the school's affiliated modern dance company and all of that. But I dropped down to a minor in dance, and then I was like, I'm not even going to get any degree in dance. I'm just going to take the classes I want, and I'll get an English degree. And so that was kind of how I found myself back fully immersed in the world of writing. And I don't know. I feel like very lucky that things not only worked out the way they did, but that I had parents who from the beginning were like, yes, you're going to be a writer. You, if that's what you want, you can do it. And now I know how like unlikely that actually was, and how many ways things could have gone wrong. Or even if they went right, I would not necessarily be making a living writing. But they were always so supportive of me that I always just kind of assumed that I could do it. Like, it was just a matter of when, not if.
So you started out with writing young adult novels.
Yeah.
What made you pivot into the romance novel that so many of us love?
Yeah. So the thing about young adult novels that I really, really loved, I mean, there's a lot of things I love about that category, but the thing that I always found a way to hook into story-wise was that coming of age aspect, the feeling that like in your teenage years, there are all these huge transformations happening, and you're kind of like renegotiating your place in the world and how you see yourself. And every experience you have is sort of like this pressure cooker experience. And so it makes really heightened emotions and like just intense feelings. And that was what I loved about writing that genre. And then when I got to around my mid-20s, I was really surprised to feel like I was having another, like a second coming of age, because I didn't feel like anybody had really talked to me about what it's like to be like a few years out of college and just be like, okay, now what? Like, I've been on a path my entire life. I've been on a track, and now I just have a job, and the job is not important to me. It's just like the way that I'm spending all of my time. And there were other things going on. I just felt like in general, my whole world was in flux. And I felt like that renegotiating of who I was and my place in the world was happening all over again. And that really interested me to realize that that's something that keeps happening. And so that's when I started writing Beach Read, which is my first romance novel. And the reason that it was a romance novel initially was just because with that coming of age that I was experiencing, I was finding myself really needing something a little bit lighter and comforting and safe feeling. And romance novels, of course, have like the guaranteed happily ever after or happy for now. And so that felt like a safe context, I guess, to explore these feelings about the world being disappointing, or, you know, people that you had relied on not being quite who you thought they were, all the things that come with the coming of age. And so that was how I kind of just tripped and fell sideways into romance. But what I found when I was writing Beach Read was that romance is a really good way to force someone through a coming of age. The same way that your teenage years are like a pressure cooker, falling in love is a pressure cooker. When you're falling in love, like, you might have a lot of fun and exciting feelings, but you also really find out what your traumas are, what you haven't healed from, like your triggers, your attachment styles. It really is an experience that is so raw and vulnerable that it really pushes you through like this emotional meat grinder. And so I realized that by writing romance, I had the opportunity to dive deeper into what I'd already been interested in, kind of these transformative moments in life. And it continued to work for me. Like, I have continued to find love stories really compelling, and also like consistently a way that a character is going to be challenged to grow and change.
I mean, I found, so that book came out in 2020, and mm-hmm. I found it during the pandemic, and I definitely needed something lighter. And that's how I came to find your books.
I mean,
and
it's weird because, you know, like with the publishing schedule, I was writing that like years before that, no idea what we were headed for. It was just sort of my own personal time of change and crisis that required, like, you know, necessitated this book from me. And then to have it coming out into the pandemic, there were a lot of questions in publishing at that time, as far as like, should we push books? Like, is anybody going to be even buying these right now? And I remember having a meeting with my team as the pandemic was sort of amping up, and we all agreed that the book needed to come out because the world was like scarier than ever. The world was scarier than ever. And it just felt like the right time for this book to be out in the world.
I thought the title was brilliant too, because I'm a wannabe marketer, and I can just imagine, like, my wife, for example, we're getting ready to go on vacation, and she's at the airport bookstore realizing she has nothing to read on the beach, and she's like, I need a good read for the beach. Oh, Beach Read.
yeah. I mean, I, the thing with the titles that my team and I have like come up with together, Beach Read was just mine. I will take credit for that. But we always try to have like some kind of winky element too. So it's like on the nose, where it's like, yes, this is a beach read, pick it up for that. But then that book is like very much about like the perception of what is the beach read. And is it like a valid form of art? Like, it's a book that's kind of like commercial fiction versus literary fiction. And is there a difference? What is the difference? And so it's really interesting because some people like really do not like that title for the book. Some people love it, but some people really do not like it because the book has a little bit more, I guess as a friend of mine calls it, it has a little bit more like blue tones in it than like warm, bright feelings. There's like a melancholy to it. But yeah, I mean, I was very excited about that title, but I also was like, or this could be a search engine optimization nightmare. And we really didn't know, because if the book didn't stick or the airports didn't want it for the airport bookstores, then it would have just gotten buried at the end of like a zillion Google searches, you know?
Right. So that book is now in the process of becoming a movie. That's got to be a whole new experience, working on the screenplay, the different dynamics between, you know, it's a very intimate process when you're writing a book. You probably have a small team. Yes. Or maybe an editor that you're working with. But what's this process been like for you? Has it changed like the flow of your day? You know, do you still have time to be thinking about what your next book is going to be? What's it been like for you? Because if I'm not mistaken, there's a couple other books that have already, the rights have been acquired. Yeah. What's going on with all of that?
Well, you're exactly right when you say that like writing a book is a very intimate experience and then adapting a book is like the exact opposite. It's like 40 people in a room. None of them agree with each other. Some of them you're like, have you read this book? Like it's a very different experience. And it's exciting and definitely super interesting. And at times, you know, discouraging and disheartening. It really is everything. But yeah, like you said, the Beach Read is in production. It's being adapted, as well as People We Meet on Vacation and Book Lovers. And they're all at various stages in the process, but I've read scripts for all of them. They're not the finished scripts, but I've read scripts for all of them, and I'm really excited about them. And I luckily have like good working relationships with the writers for each of them. So it does feel like there is like space for me to be kind of the representative of the reader. And that's been the main thing that I have tried to be in this process, is like knowing that like I have to let go of it. It's not my thing anymore. It belongs to everyone else who's working on it. They have to put their thumbprints on it and shape it so that it works as a film versus as a book. But my job really is to be there for the reader, because I know what they really, really love about the books. And I know what they'll desperately miss if it's not in there. And I know like the things that they really hate that can't be added without compromising the feelings that they have for the story. So it's like a kind of stressful position to be in, but it's also exciting and interesting. Like it feels good to have something that I'm new to. Like I generally prefer to just be good at something already, but it's fun to be in the middle of something that I'm not good at yet. Something that is new and different and not my world. But yeah, I guess I'll say like the main thing that it has really taught me is that it is an absolute miracle when any movie gets made, let alone a good movie. So now I'm like, I am blown away that we have as many movies as we do, because it really is such a slow moving machine, because there's just thousands of parts. Like so many people have to sign off on every decision before it can inch forward. And luckily we're still making progress on all three fronts, but it is a very different experience from publishing.
Are any of them cast yet? Like, with the stars who are going to play these characters are so near and dear to our hearts.
Go ahead.
I mean, what the characters are so near and dear to our heart, like picking someone to play them, I think would be hard.
Yeah, definitely. And of course, like, again, I'm not the person in charge on any of these projects. I am one voice of many, but I am there to be the representative of the reader. Like that is my whole goal. So when they bring, you know, potential cast to me, I am really just thinking like, not just can I see it, but like, do I think the readers will get on board? And nothing is like public at this point. Nothing is technically official at this point, but there have been movements in casting that I am very excited about and that I think the readers will be very excited about. But yeah, it's like, you know, it's like a hurry up and wait kind of business where like, but with one of the announcements, when one of the film announcements went out, it was like, we've been sitting on this for probably at least a year. And then suddenly it was just like up on deadline or yeah. something. It's like, you really don't know when things are going to start moving. So there isn't much more that I can share yet that hasn't already been shared.
Sherry was really hoping you were going to break news on our podcast today.
Yeah, I wish I could. I wish I could. We'll see. I mean, the good thing is, so romance has been a really hard genre to get made for years, other than like, you know, Hallmark or Netflix, who will make kind of smaller budget films and shows. But like, to get a romance, especially a romantic comedy, made on like a studio scale is so hard and has been so hard. And so this year has been huge for that, because we had Anyone But You, the Sydney Sweeney, Glenn Powell movie, and then The Idea of You, the Anne Hathaway-led adaptation that just came out last week, or this week maybe, the last few days on Amazon. And both of those have been doing really well, and I think show like the hunger in the market. So hopefully that will just kind of get things moving a little bit faster.
They do need to understand. I mean, I had so much fun going to the Barbie movie with my friends. Like, there just aren't like a lot of movies where you can get all your girlfriends and go. And plus, that's a huge part of TikTok now, of like, we saw yeah. that with Anyone But You, like just huge groups of girlfriends going to see it and then making a TikTok about going to see it. It's part of marketing.
I know. I mean, this is an ongoing conversation, and it's interesting because I'm having this conversation constantly, even with a lot of people in the film industry, but it's more like producers or, you know, writers, directors who are all saying the same thing. But at the end of the day, you still have to have the people who sign the checks like on board, and they have to believe in it. But it's so true. Like, the Barbie movie was huge. It made so much money. And like, it was like, yeah, of course it made so much money. This is just like a international themed party that you have created for people to go to with their friends. But you know, after that movie performed that well, we saw all of the news where it was just like, Monopoly movie is greenlit. Like, we're doing toy movies now. And it was kind of missing the point of why Barbie was specifically something people wanted to go spend their money on, and who was going to spend that money. It wasn't like toy collectors necessarily. Right. It was just like women who have like nostalgia for their girlhood and complicated feelings too about girlhood and womanhood. And yeah, that's like, romance has always had all of those things. So we'll get there. But it's just like slowly making its way to the top instead of it being like a top-down decision to embrace this market.
So you do live in Cincinnati. So I feel like we have to ask you some of your favorite Cincinnati things to do.
Okay.
So when you're here, like, what do you like to do in your free time?
Oh, gosh. I mean, most of my free time is reading. I guess I can just, I'm like, you know, if I want to go peruse books, like, I'll go to Joseph Beth, of course. I love them, and it's such a good store. We're really, really lucky to have such a good indie bookstore in our hometown. I mean, it's like kind of just all the traditional things. Like, yes, I do love Graters, and that is a staple, probably my favorite ice cream. Lately, I have some friends with young kids who have like zoo memberships. So I've really loved going to the Cincinnati Zoo with kids and watching them be so excited and also be able to name like 45 different kinds of birds that I've never heard of. That's very fun.
And you get to see Fiona.
Like, the Ziegler pool downtown is great.
That's true. And Ziegler should be opening any day now, would be my guess.
Yes. Yes, it's about time.
Do you live downtown?
No, I am kind of like up near College Hill.
Oh, I love a good shout out for our neighborhoods.
Yeah. There's just so many hidden gems in the city.
So for the guys that listen to our podcast, before we started recording, I had to confess that while Sherry has read every book, me being a dude in my 50s, have not. But in researching for this podcast, I really got intrigued with the storyline for Funny Story. And so I'm going to commit to diving into that. And then Sherry and I can talk about the book. We can have our own, like, you know, personal book club on the book. But as I asked you earlier, and I wanted to revisit it, are you seeing more men wanting to participate in this experience you're creating?
Yeah, I for sure am. And it's really exciting to me. Obviously, that's not to say I don't hugely appreciate and love my female readership. I do. But it is always like a nice little surprise and sort of tickles me when I get nice messages from men who love my books, or, you know, if I'm like signing, doing personalized copies and so signing pre-orders for people, and it's like a man's name comes through. That's always really exciting to me, because I think like such a huge piece of this genre's history has kind of been steeped in bias against it and like stigma. And even growing up, I felt like the 90s were like obviously not a good time to be a girl or a woman, but an extension of that was like, it's really not a good time to be a romance reader. Like, romance was being treated as like humiliating and shameful, and like the women who read it were just portrayed as kind of like desperate and sad. And so I hadn't even read a romance novel until I was a full-blown adult, like probably 24 or 25. And when I did, I was really shocked how good everything I was picking up was. And especially for me, as someone who loves character-driven story, like that is my favorite thing across any genre. If I'm reading a thriller, if I'm reading science fiction, if I'm reading literary fiction, I just want real depth to the characters and to feel like I'm understanding who they are and why they're making the decisions they're making. And so reading romance, I was blown away because it felt like the percentage of books that had really strong character work was overall higher than it was in other genres. Like, it felt like that was something that consistently writers in that genre were really interested in and understood the intricacies of. And like, obviously, it's also very important to have good characters if the whole plot of the book is basically two people falling in love. Like, for there to be plot, you have to have character. And I've watched in the last few years with like book talk, especially, the conversation around romance has changed so much. And a huge part of that has been Gen Z readers embracing the genre and like talking about what they love about it and not acting like weird and squeamish about it. Just kind of being like, oh, I love this romance. And there's nothing embarrassing about that. And I think that is now starting to trickle into like kind of gender lines. Like, I feel like men are like, it was like first Gen Z was like, hey, there's nothing embarrassing about loving books about love. There's nothing embarrassing about being interested in love, or there's nothing like innately inferior about art that is concerning itself with love and human relationships. Like, why would we ever think that? And so now I feel like the last frontier sort of is like straight men starting to read romance and to acknowledge all of those things, to acknowledge that there's nothing strange or shameful about them being interested in love or romantic love stories. Like, it feels like a reckoning that has been happening very, very slowly, that started long before I was even reading in the genre. And it's just really exciting to now get to like witness that with represented within my own readership.
Well, and you've gotten a lot of praise for not falling into the trap of the standard cookie cutter romance. You know, when I hear someone say romance novel, and this is going to date me, I see a paperback Fabio. With Fabio on the cover. Yeah.
Yes.
Or a guy that looks like Fabio because of, yeah. You know, yeah. But you get a lot of credit for not getting trapped into those tropes and making it, much more of a, like you talked about character development and you talked about, the underlying stories can be a little blue and all of that. What do you credit that to? Was that intentional?
Ooh, that's such a good question. Oh, well, okay. So first of all, I do want to acknowledge that, like, of course, I'm not the only person doing that. So I'm really, really grateful that readers say, you know, feel that way, feel that, like, I'm making real complicated characters. But there really are a lot of people doing that. And I think there really were, even back when those covers were in style. But I was like you, where it was like those covers were, they were something that was putting me off. They were like a barrier of entry to me as a reader, partly because of the stigma around them and partly because it was like, I don't know people who look like that. Like, this just feels so separate from my world.
Other,
I don't
other
know
than Fabio
if I'm
himself, nobody looks then, like that.
They would
yeah,
be in,
right,
like, they'd be in then, the library and, on the oh, circular racks of like all yes. tucked one behind each other, just kind of jammed in the big circle racks.
Yes. Which now that I'm like fully through the gates of romance, like nothing could be more thrilling to me than just seeing that. Like, I love those thick mass market paperbacks, just hundreds of them, a wall wrapped around the cylinder. But yeah, like there was this huge shift in the perception of romance when publishers started using like the cute illustrated covers that my books have had, because it was like removing that barrier of entry. It was like people were less like shy, I think, about picking those books up. And also it maybe made it clearer, like, this is really rooted in our real world. Like, probably you're not going to picture Fabio as the lead. You can if you so choose. But
Miles would be appalled if anyone ever compared him to Fabio.
Yes. And it just simply would not happen. It would not happen. But I think you're exactly right that it's because it's so character driven. And I think that there is this other idea that like romance, part of like the perception of romance is that it is just all sheer fantasy and that's what women like about it. And there is romance that's fantasy and that's okay and has its place. But I think it's not an accurate depiction of the romance reader. I think that romance readers want characters who feel real to them. And I think that specifically means the characters cannot be perfect. It's when you're reading a book and a character is perfect, you're aware that they're a character because you're like, no one is perfect. No one is perfect. This just doesn't work. And I think when we see a character's flaws and their hangups and their idiosyncrasies, I actually think as readers, that not only makes them feel real to us, but I think makes us feel like an intimacy with them, a closeness with them, and an affection that is like the same way that you feel in real life as you get to know someone and you find out like surprising things about them, like funny little nicknames that they had as a kid, things that like maybe would be embarrassing tidbits they wouldn't want to share like the first time you met them. But the longer you know someone, those little details are like these kernels you store up and treasure. And that's really the way that I approach writing these characters and writing the male leads specifically. It's like, I don't set out to make them perfect, just like I don't set out to make the female leads perfect. I really set out to make them just like decent, just like decent humans with good intentions who don't always do the right thing.
So I do want to be respectful of your time, but before we let you go, I do want to ask, what was it like the day you found out you were number one on the New York Times bestseller list? Every writer's dream. It's every writer's dream.
It's so hard to even explain. The first time that happened was with People We Meet on Vacation, my second romance novel. And I do remember that time very clearly because my editor called to tell me, and I just kind of started screaming no at her. Like, it didn't feel right. I don't know. I think it felt like a dream that I needed to wake up from or something. And so I was just like, no, no, no. And then after it sunk in and we got off the phone, like, I would be really happy, but then I would start thinking, wait, did I mishear her? Am I misremembering? And I would have to kind of double check. It felt very, very, very surreal. And every time since has also felt incredibly surreal. This last time the list came out, like super early, it usually comes out around the same time of day. And so I had like a meeting scheduled with my team where we were going to get on Zoom and just kind of wait. And I was feeling very nervous about that because you don't want to be on a Zoom call when you get bad news. And then my agent just texted me when the list landed early and was like, just so you know, it's like good news. And so we got to all celebrate formally together like an hour later. But yeah, it continues to be so, so, so surreal and weird and magical.
Well, you guys, if you haven't read it yet, I encourage you to grab it now. It's almost beach
She's
season.
She's looking me straight in the eyes, Emily. She's talking right to me.
It's almost beach season, but you don't need the beach to read them. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. So you know what makes me sad about that interview, Burl?
It's over.
It's over. Now I have to wait another year for a book. However, maybe we'll have a movie before then. Maybe. That would be so exciting.
Oh, I bet her book comes out before the movie.
I don't know. She's been working on the movies for a while.
I know. Was doing my research. We shall see. It sounded like they might be close. So. Like when she said, I can't say, she had something to say she couldn't
agree.
Say.
Agree. She knows things. I think, so. Yeah.
All right. So, you went to the Kentucky Derby, Sherry.
I did, and it's kind of that so Cincinnati. Although I was commenting, I didn't see a lot of people.
You didn't see a lot of people from Cincinnati?
You know, people that...
There are 125,000 people there from around the world, Sherry.
So you'd think I would see somebody.
You think you might... Well, no, I was just going to say, there probably were people there, but it might be hard to run into them.
Oh, that's true.
Unless you had a meeting place.
It was my first Derby, 150th... And it was
that was your first Kentucky.
It was my first
Wait
one.
A minute.
It was.
You never miss a party. How could this possibly have been your first?
It. Well, I did it right, and I went to Derby, the Oaks, the Derby. I had a really. My friend Christina lives there now, and so we had a really.
So you didn't have to drive back between the Oaks and the Derby.
No, or pay for a hotel because I can only imagine. Yeah. So we had. It was really just an experience, like the people watching and to see everything.
Now, I've been to Reds games with you, and for you, it's not about what's on the field. It's about
the event,
yeah. the socializing, the you know, bringing people together for fun. Did you watch any of the races?
I did. I was with people.
Did
who
you
were,
bet?
I did on some people's recommendations. I did not win anybody.
Did not win.
And
yeah,
I didn't go crazy. I mean, I don't really know that much about horse racing. So I'm more pragmatic of like, since I don't know, then why would I spend my money on
right,
it?
Yeah.
But it was fun to like place a bet at the window and like to do
where,
that.
Where did you find your hat for the Derby? And did you have a different hat for the Oaks? Did you have to
yes,
have
I did.
Totally
I had,
different outfits?
Yes. I wore clothes that I had, like vintage clothes, and then I bought hats on Etsy.
Okay.
But a hat, like from sellers that specialized in derby hats and making the derby hats very special. So that was a fun little fashion project.
Well, I've been. It is a great time. And it is, if you're into people watching, oh my goodness.
What? They were very long days. We went from the beginning all the way to the end.
All right. Well, that's a great weekend, Sherry. Shall we wrap this up?
Yes.
All right.
Thank you for listening to That's So Cincinnati podcast, a production of The Inquirer and Cincinnati.com.
That's So Cincinnati is sponsored this week by Cincinnati.com, the online home to The Inquirer. If you'd like to sponsor an episode listened to by thousands each week, email me personally at belove@cincinnati.com.
That's So Cincinnati was produced today by Phil Didion. Lisa Gillespie books our guests. If you'd like what you're hearing, please subscribe on your favorite podcast platform and share us with a friend.
And finally, if you value local journalism, please consider a digital subscription to The Inquirer. Just click on subscribe at the top of Cincinnati.com. And remember, I want your ugly, I want your disease, I want your everything as long as it's free.